three
she's
lights
happy about
and then take
it.
The next left.
I don't really
then drive
think
five
she's
more
happy,
blocks
but
and you should be
who
there.
Who am I to judge, right?
Park
anyway,
on the right.
That's
I'll
what
see you
I heard
later tonight.
Night.
It's hard to concentrate on two things at once, like texting and driving. Stop the text, stop the wrecks. How will you stop texting and driving? Tell us at stoptextstoprex.org. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
WHFR and Metaphysically Speaking are teaming up once again in order to bring you our fifth annual Festival of Enlightenment Holistic Fair on Saturday, March 23rd from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. in the Henry Ford Community College Student and Culinary Arts Center. As usual, we are thrilled and excited to bring you this premier holistic event. This year's festival promises to be bigger and better than ever. If you would like to join us as a vendor, reader, or body healer, please call 313-317-6540 or email us at holistic2010@peoplepc.com. Once again, that's call us at 313-317-6540 or email us at holistic2010@peoplepc.com. We hope you are able to join us at this fantastic festival.
The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford Community College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone. Where local investigators, as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists, share their latest evidence in support of the UFO reality. Hi, I'm David Twitchell, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn. WHFR.fm is the station making waves, and for the next hour, we'll be exploring the mysteries of the UFO and abduction phenomenon. Now, a while back, we had Disclosure Project members on the program here, on the show, and this was from a press conference at the prestigious National Press Club in Washington, D.C. on May the 9th, 2001. And we gave you some of their testimonies, and we got requests that we do some more of Disclosure Projects. So today we're going to do a few of those testimonies, a very short sound bites, maybe 5 minutes, of UFO insiders. Now, as a reminder, the Disclosure Project is headed by Dr. Stephen Greer, and he has gathered together more than 400 witnesses, insiders, whistleblowers, if you will, that have been part of the UFO phenomenon and its cover-up. And these are high-ranking military, government, and corporate officials who were involved, like I say, in the UFO phenomenon and its cover-up, and most are retired now, so they feel they can come forward. Some of them are asking for a release from their security clearance, although their legal advisor, Daniel Sheehan, a well-respected attorney in Washington, involved with many high-profile cases, tells us that they're really not under any security blanket because these it's their black operations. they're black operations, and the American people have a right to know these things. So they are threatened with prison, imprisonment, losing their pension, and that kind of thing, should they come out with this truth. However, if they come out with this truth, that UFOs are real, that there's been crashes on terra firma of extraterrestrial craft, complete with bodies dead and alive, and they prosecute them, if the government prosecutes them for releasing a secret, well, that's telling you that there is a secret to be kept. So they deal with it another way. Right now, they simply ignore them. Now, the Disclosure Project members are trying to get, begging for, open congressional hearings so that they may impart their knowledge. And, like I say, blow the whistle on the UFO phenomenon. However, so far they have been, like I say, ignored. So what I'd like to do now is play some of these sound bites from the 2001 press conference in Washington, D.C. And the first one is Adana Hare, and she is a former NASA employee. Let's listen to her.
Thank you, Carl. Good morning, everyone. My name is Donna Hare, and I worked at Philco Ford Aerospace from 1967 to 1981. During that time, I was a design illustrator, draftsman. I did the launch slides and landing slides, and also projecting plotting boards, lunar maps for NASA. We were a contractor, but most of the time I worked on site, in Building 8. I had the opportunity to do extra work during downtime, which was between missions, and I walked into a photo lab, which was the NASA lab, across the hallway. I had a secret clearance, which is not that high, but I was able to go into restricted areas, which this was. At the time, I was talking to one of the techs in there, and he drew my attention to a photograph, a NASA photograph. It had a dot on it. And I said, what is that? Well, he drew my attention to it, and I said, is that a dot on the emulsion? And he said, and he's smiling, and he has his hands crossed, and he said, round dots on the emulsion don't leave round shadows on the ground. And this was an aerial photograph of the Earth, I'm assuming the Earth, because it had pine trees on it, and the shadows of the craft, or whatever it was, were in the same angle as the trees. And by its very nature, UFO, and I wanted to clarify that to a gentleman that was talking to me, means unidentified. So I did not know what this was. But I realized at this point that it's very secret, that it was kept secret, because I asked him, what are you going to do with this piece of information? And he said, we always airbrush these out before we sell them to the public. So they're pesky little creatures appearing on this photograph they wanted to get rid of. After that, I decided I would ask questions to other people that worked there. And I found that I had to ask them away from the site and not on site. A guard told me that he was asked to burn some photographs and not to look at them. And there was a guard, another guard guarding him, who was in green fatigues, watching him burn the photographs. And he said he was too tempted. He looked at one, and it was a picture of a UFO. And he was very descriptive. I can go into that later with anyone. He immediately was hit in the head, and he had a big gash in his forehead. He was knocked out, and he's terrified. So he would have to be protected. Another incident, I knew someone in quarantine with the Apollo astronauts. He told me that the Apollo astronauts saw craft on the moon when we landed, and that is what he told me. And he also was afraid. He said that the astronauts are told to keep this quiet. They're not allowed to talk about it. So I do want to let you know that I worked out there for a number of years, and this I ran into this. So it's not something everyone knows that works out there for a long time. My boss didn't know about it. Some people that sat right next to me didn't know about it. It's very strange, because I don't know how they can do it, but they can let some people know about it and then others not. I'm willing to testify before Congress that what I'm saying is true, and Thank you very much.
Good morning. My name is Dwayne Arneson. I served 26 years as a communication electronics officer in the U.S. Air Force, all over the world, including Vietnam. I was lucky to be selected to be commander of three different units in the Air Force. I held a top secret SCI TK clearance, and for those who know, it is slightly above top secret. I retired in 1986 as a colonel at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio. I would like to relate about three different experiences, if you will, that relate to UFOs. As a young lieutenant over in Germany, Ramstein Air Base, Germany, back in the early 60s, I was in charge of the cryptographic center. I had a top secret crypto clearance at that time, and I can clearly recall seeing a message that went through my crypto center which said that a UFO had crashed on the island of Spitsbergen, Norway, and the team of scientists were coming to investigate it. Going forward to the 1967 time frame, I was assigned to the 28th Air Division at Great Falls, Montana, and I was the officer in charge of the communications center there. Also, I was a top secret patrol officer for the division. I had a crypto account, I was an account custodian, and I also passed out nuclear launch authenticators. During that time, I can recall seeing a message come through that communications center which said, basically what Bob was just got through talking about, is that a UFO was seen near the missile silos and the missiles were deactivated. Coincidentally, the person that Boeing sent to investigate the particular missile conditions, if you will, what made them shut down, was my first manager at Boeing, Mr. Bob Kaminsky, who has since passed away. And I can recall him on different occasions. He lived close to me in Auburn, Washington. That's where I'm from. And he said, Arnie, he says, those missiles were perfectly clean. That was the result. So then one last incident concerned when I was as a commander of the unit in Caswell Air Force Station, Maine. I had contacts with the security police at Loring Air Force Base, and they told about UFOs that were seen near the nuclear weapon storage areas on Loring Air Force Base. And I'll be glad to testify to Congress that this is absolutely the truth. Thank you.
First, that was Dwayne Arneson, Air Force Colonel, speaking about our missile silos being deactivated, the missiles being deactivated. Now, they say that UFOs don't pose any threat to our national security. Well, they had UFOs hovering over our missile silos, nuclear bases, and the missiles were wiped clean. The codes to launch codes were wiped clean. Those missiles would not have launched in case of a nuclear attack. To me, this is a matter of national concern. Not that I'm panicking over it, and not that you should panic over it either. I think that what they were doing was just letting us know, you know, we have this kind of power. We're not going to use it against you, but we don't want you using it against each other. And we certainly don't want you taking your petty wars with your nuclear weapons out into space. There was also a story that I don't know how true it is, but allegedly a missile was fired at the moon to try to test this missile, this nuclear bomb on the moon, and it was intercepted by a UFO in space. And there was another disclosure project witness who came forward and stated that they were testing just the missiles. There were no warheads on it. They're just testing the carrier for a warhead, the missile. And they were videotaping it while it was being tested. Then it was up in the air, and the next day, this colonel was called in, or captain, whatever he was at the time, and The colonel said to him, what was going on up there? Meanwhile, there's a guy standing in a suit over on the side of the room. Didn't identify himself, just standing there, didn't talk, didn't speak to him at all, just standing there. The colonel says, what were you guys doing out there? Having a little fun out there? What was going on? He says, no, sir, nothing. The missile just blew up in the air. So he puts on the video, and here is a UFO coming in to the missile, going around the missile, shooting little rays of light at the head of the missile, and the missile just tumbled to the ground, and then the UFO took off. And Colonel said to him, what does that look like to you? He says, sir, it looks like we've got a UFO. And the colonel says, I don't ever want to hear those words out of your mouth again. This is a non-event. It never happened. And like I say, the guy in the suit never said a word to him. And before that, we had Donna Hare, former NASA employee, speaking about the pictures of in NASA photos. And I've heard very often, you know, they've got satellites all around the Earth. If these UFOs were real, they'd be caught on satellite pictures all the time. Well, as Donna Hare testified, the former NASA employee testified, they are caught on these pictures all of the time, except they're airbrushed out. Now, that sounds a bit fantastic, but there are many things that many pictures that are sanitized for security reasons. And NASA, there's a video out there, a DVD called Evidence of NASA UFOs. Dr. David Sirita does this. And it's just tremendous. Actual footage from NASA's own archives of UFOs around the tether, if you recall back in the... I can't remember what date it was now, but this tether incident was supposed to be a communications wire that was put up there in space, and the tether broke. Well, the wire is only 1/16 of an inch thick, and it was 100 miles away from 100 nautical miles away from the craft and from the space shuttle, and as they're taking pictures of this, the thing is swarmed by UFOs. Now, that 1/16 of an inch cable that's 100 nautical miles away from the camera appeared very wide, but the camera was capable of seeing into the ultraviolet spectrum. And because of that, what we were seeing was not the wire itself or the tether itself, but was the energy that was being created by this tether. And given it was the camera could see into the ultraviolet spectrum, it also saw these UFOs that couldn't be seen. They were disc-shaped objects with black centers and a black notch on the side. Now, it's theorized that, number one, we cannot see, of course, into the ultraviolet spectrum, only visible light. But this camera could. And that hole in the center and the black notch on the side are not really holes, are not really gaps. But the energy is so great that it is even outside of the ultraviolet spectrum. Now, NASA's trying to say that these are fuzzy disks, as they call them. And there's even an example of the fuzzy disk on this video, where if you take a camera and purposely, manually take it out of focus, if we're looking through a window, there's condensation on the outside of the window, of course, in the shuttle, that's would stand to reason. This condensation, these drops, seem to balloon up, and that's what they call the fuzzy disks, and big round dots. But they have no dark hole. There is no black notch on the side. And they're perfectly stationary. Compare that, and the reason that this cameraman or the astronaut on the shuttle manually took this camera out of focus was because there was something passing by the window, a flashing light passing by the window, and he took it out of focus, I'm guessing, so that people back on Earth could not see what it was. And that's where those fuzzy discs came into play. But like I say, they were not moving like the other things. The other objects were moving, making right-hand turns, pretty much examining that tether. So many things going on. I wanted to remind you that you're listening to We Are Not Alone on WHFR.FM, Making Waves. And right now we're going to play another excerpt from the Disclosure Project press conference. We had George Filer on the show. He is the Eastern Director of MUFON, and he is also Disclosure Project member, and I'm proud to say a co-author of our book, Filer's Files, Worldwide Reports of UFO sightings. So let's take a listen to George Filer was at the press conference. So let's take a listen to George Filer.
My name is George Filer III. The reason I'm here is because George Filer V is in the hangar and will be born on Friday. And I'm a retired intelligence officer and flyer with almost 5,000 hours, and I didn't believe in UFOs until London Control called us in the winter of 1962 and asked us, would we chase one? And we said, sure. So we let down from 30,000 feet to 1,000 feet where the UFO was hovering, and we went into a steep dive and actually exceeded the red line of the aircraft. So it's kind of dangerous chasing UFOs. Any case, I was able to get the UFO on the aircraft radar at about 40 miles, and we could see a light out in the distance, and as we closed, we kept on picking up this radar return. Point I'm mentioning that the radar return was very distinct and solid, indicating it was some kind of a metallic object. We got about a mile from the UFO, and it kind of lit up in the sky and went off into space, very similar to what the shuttle looks like when it takes off. Later on, I was working in intelligence in Vietnam. I briefed General Brown about UFOs when I was in 21st Air Force, McGuire Air Force Base. Briefed General Glau about a UFO over Tehran, Iran in 1976. That two F-4s from the Iranian Air Force had taken off and try to intercept the UFO, and when they turned on their fire control systems, they immediately went out, all the electrical systems went out, the planes had to return to base. This was particularly significant because it was also picked up on satellites. In 1978, on January 18th, I was going into the base. Every morning I did the briefing to the general staff, and I noticed that there are some lights off in the distance at the end of the runway there. And when I got into the command post, the senior master sergeant in charge said that there had been UFOs in the pattern all night. They're on radar. The tower had seen them. They got in aircraft reports and so on. And that one had landed or crashed at Fort Dix. Fort Dix and McGuire are right together. And this is kind of like the Roswell of the East. But in any case, an alien had come off the craft and had been shot by a military policeman and apparently was wounded and was heading for McGuire. So for whatever reason, the aliens liked the Air Force better than the Army, perhaps because they're shooting at them. But in any case, our security police went out there and found him on the end of the runway dead. And they asked me to brief the general staff, General Tom Sadler, and at the 8 o'clock stand-up briefing. And I said, I don't think I want to do this. You know, the general doesn't have a good sense of humor, and I'm not sure I believe this. So I did some checking, called the 438th Command Post, and everybody had pretty much the same story. And at 8 o'clock that morning, just before I went on, was going to brief this, and I was very worried about it. They said, don't brief it, that it's too hot, so to speak. That's pretty much my story, and I'm prepared to tell the story in front of Congress, and it is the truth. Now, because of this, I've stayed interested in UFOs, and I'm the Eastern Director of the Mutual UFO Network. And between the National Reporting Center and Peter Davenport and the MUFON, we get 100 reports a week on average of people from all over the United States that see these things regularly. And if you start checking, they're out there and they're low, and people are seeing them all the time. And these are highly qualified people, all of whom essentially give us the reports by email. Thank you.
Major George Filer, Eastern Director for the Mutual UFO Network, or MUFON. And like I say, he was on a show. He's an author, or co-author with me, on Filer's Files, Worldwide Reports of UFO Sightings. He has the Filer's Files newsletter weekly, keeping everyone abreast of the latest UFO sighting reports. You can go to his website at nationalufocenter.com. That's nationalufocenter.com. Right now, let's hear from Graham Bethune.
My name is Graham Bethune. I'm a retired Navy commander, pilot, had a top secret clearance. 50 years ago, February the 10th, 1951, I was flying from Keflavik, Iceland to Argentia, Newfoundland. It was at night. It was dark. About 300 miles outside of Argentia, I saw a glow on the water, like approaching a city at night. As we approached this glow, it turned to a monstrous circle of white lights on the water. We watched this for a while. The lights went out. There was nothing on the water. Next thing we saw was a yellow halo, small, much smaller than whatever it was launched from, and that was 15 miles away, up to our altitude. Because of the trajectory, I disengaged the autopilot, shoved the nose over to try to go under this thing. At that time, I heard a noise underneath. I thought maybe it hit us. It was actually some of the crew members ducking, and they collided, and a couple of them were injured. Then it appeared over to the right and moved out slowly and flew with us. It was still not at our altitude, but we could see the shape of it. It had a dome. We could see the coronal discharge. I went back aft, let the other pilot, Al Jones, take my seat to see what the passenger's reaction was. Came back to the cockpit, told him not to report anything, simply because what that psychiatrist had said to me, maybe they would lock us up. So basically, the instruments in the cockpit, we had four or five failures in the area of magnetic compass, you know, the electromagnetic effect, and area of directional finders and this type of thing. The craft was tracked by radar in excess of 1,800 miles an hour. It never did get to our altitude. We had 31 passengers, plus the psychiatrists and the crew members, that all sighted this at different areas. When we landed at Argentia, Newfoundland, we were interrogated by the Air Force, an excellent interrogation, Captain Paulson. When we landed at the Naval Air Test Center here at Patuxent River, we were required by Navy intelligence to make out individual reports. Out of the National Archives, I have the 18-page official Navy and Air Force report. I've made up a report to straighten out all the truth. There's a stack of books out there this high that have written all of this up. So the truth is here. I will testify under oath before Congress that everything that I have said is true.
That was former Air Force pilot Graham Bethune. one little story. See, they only had a little bit of time, maybe 5 minutes, they were allotted to give their testimonies at the press conference, because there's 21 of them. So one little piece of the story that he failed to tell, that he has told in the book Disclosure, that's put out by the Disclosure Project. One little humorous story is that when he went back to after seeing this phenomenon, he went back to the passengers and he spoke to the psychiatrist. Now, this was an Air Force psychiatrist. And he said to the psychiatrist, "Did you see that, sir?" And the psychiatrist said, "Yes, that was a UFO, but I didn't look because those things don't exist." So I thought that was rather humorous. I think that's what the attitude a lot of people have, is that, yes, I'm looking right at it, but I don't believe it because they don't exist. Conventional wisdom tells me they don't exist. My logic tells me they don't exist. They don't exist, and yet there they are. So we'll go ahead now with testimony by John Callahan.
My name is John Callahan. I'm a retired FAA employee. I was the division manager for the Accidents Evaluation and Investigation Division in D.C. About 2 years before I retired, I received a call from Alaska Region, where the region wanted to know what to tell the media. When I questioned, "Tell the media what?" he says, "About the UFO," and it went downhill from there. "What UFO?" It turned out I told them what any government employee would do at that time, was to tell them it's under investigation. And then I had them send all that data to the FAA's tech center in Atlantic City. The next day, my immediate boss, service director, Javi Safir, and I went to Atlantic City. I just purchased a new video camera, and I videoed the event. In Atlantic City, we had them play back on a scope, you would call a scope, a plan view display, PVD, exactly what the pilot seen or what the controller seen, and we tied that in with the voice tape so we could hear exactly what the controller said and what he heard, and we taped it. We came back the next day, briefed the administrator, Admiral Ingen, on what happened. He wanted a 5-minute briefing. After we started the briefing, he wanted to know if he could see the video. We put the video on. He watched the video, the whole video. The next day, he set up a meeting for me to give a dog and pony show to President Reagan's scientific staff and whoever they brought over, and to hand off all that data to them. That morning in the FAA round room, it was either 9 or 10 o'clock, three men from Reagan's scientific staff, three CIA people, three FBI people, and I don't remember who the other guys were, along with all the FAA experts that I brought with me. They could decide or talk about the hardware and the software, how it worked. We put on a dog and pony show. We let them watch the video. We had all the data there. We had all the printouts that the computer put out. They got all excited over it. When it was all done, the CIA, one of the CIA men told the people they were now sworn to secrecy, that this meeting never happened and this event never happened. So when I asked them why, I thought it was probably just a stealth bomber at the time. He says, "Well, this is the first time that we have recorded radar data on a UFO, and these guys are going to get all excited. They're drooling over all this data." I said, "Well, you're going to tell the public about it." And he says, "No, we don't tell the public about this. It would panic the public." He says, "We're going to go back and study this." I said, "Okay." That was what he was going to do. Now, I've told this story many times, and I get sometimes funny looks from people. I have with me the voice tapes of the controllers that were involved, the FAA original tapes. See, after we handed this stuff off to the president's staff, the FAA didn't know what to do with it. We don't separate UFOs from real traffic, so it's not our problem. Okay? I have a copy of the original of the video that we took, which is rather interesting. And once the thing was all over, the report started coming into my office. But because it wasn't an FAA air traffic problem, the FAA's report ended up on a table in my office and stayed there until I retired when one of the staffers packed up all my gear and helped it move to my house. Also, in a box I found just a few days ago in my 1992 tax return, I have the target printouts from the computer data, which so if you wanted to or look at every target that was up there at the time, you can now reproduce this from this piece of paper here. And it's called the UFO Incident, Japan 1648, I believe the number was, that happened on November the 18th, 1986. I'm prepared to go to Congress, to swear before Congress that everything I've told you people and everything that is here is the truth. Thank you.
John Callahan. You know, he's, anybody who says that there's no evidence of UFOs or extraterrestrial craft, I got to qualify the word UFO or the term UFO. UFO means unidentified flying object. Now, that could be anything. You know, object that's in the sky, flying in the sky, that one cannot readily identify. But that is different from extraterrestrial craft. And there's much evidence to suggest that some of these, not all, very few in fact, are extraterrestrial or other dimensional craft. And it only takes one true case out of all the millions that have been reported over the years to be real, and then your case for it's non-existent goes out the window. An interesting statistic is the fact that polls show that out of the millions that have been of reports that we get like 2,000 reports per year, and around the world, and that accounts for like 11% of the actual sightings, because people are just afraid to report them because of fear of ridicule, and that's pretty much what they have in mind is to ridicule. Deny and ridicule is their policy, and they've admitted it in documents that were secret and have since been declassified and released to the public. They want to deny, and they want to ridicule the witnesses. But this thing with John Callahan, where he ended up with all this hard physical evidence, is that one hand doesn't know what the other hand is doing in the military and in the government, and one department doesn't know what the other department is doing, and they don't know what is secret about this UFO phenomenon and what is not. And that way, because of that, people end up with evidence left behind that they should have collected and hidden if they want to keep this secret, but they leave it behind. And then later, people like John Callahan stumble across it. This is WHFR.FM, Making Waves. This you're listening to We Are Not Alone. And I'm David Twitchell, and we're listening to Disclosure Project members, insiders, military, government, corporate officials who are finally coming forward. I was saying earlier that most of them are retired. Some of them are not. Some of them still hold their jobs, and I don't know if they're going to for very long if they become whistleblowers, but they have a lot to lose. And they're seeking open congressional hearings. Now, you can look at this one of two ways. If they're lying, they deserve to be punished. And if they're crazy, they deserve to, they should get help or be institutionalized. Now, they're seeking open congressional hearings where they are going to swear under oath as to what they're saying is true and offer physical evidence to prove it. If they're lying, they're going to prison. They're ruining their reputation. You got over 400 of them. And like I say, if they're insane, they should be locked up. Here's an opportunity for Congress to settle this matter once and for all. And they have been begging for open congressional hearings since May of 2001. Now, I grant you that a lot has happened since May of 2001 that takes up Congress's time. However, here it is several years later. It's been a while, and they've had an opportunity to call these people in, put them on the hot seat, let them state what they say is true, and show their evidence. And if they're lying under oath to Congress, then we should know it, and they should be penalized for it. So give them that opportunity. Let them have their day in court, so to speak. Now let's listen to another Disclosure Project member by the name of John Maynard.
My name is John Maynard. I'm retired Army. I retired as a Sergeant First Class. My entire year, 21 years of service, I held a top secret clearance. Compartmentalized at times to as high as TK, Omni, Crypto, and others. I had access to very, very sensitive documents. My testimony is basically two-pronged. One, I retired from DIA in 1980. And when, as an administrator, you take over an office, you take over everything and you sign for everything. And I signed for well over 2,000 documents. In order to sign and inventory those things, you have to read them. Not word for word, but basically I went through every document to make sure that it was complete. It was there, as they told me, that when I turned my charge over to the next person, the same documents were there. So I got quite a good knowledge of what was going on in those documents. And believe me, there are many, many different references to UFOs. There was also NPIC pictures that shows that it would targeted objects that were casing them out. Now, I worked on the SALT 1 and SALT 2 areas for the office that I worked in. So we were taking pictures all the time for verification of nuclear disarmament. And there were some objects in those pictures that didn't belong there. The second prong to this whole thing is that a lot of people talk about conspiracies over a shadow government. I'm willing to testify before Congress that these black operations do exist. I nearly became part of it. But I saw the light, I think. Or was it? And I got out. And that's it. We have to disclose what we know. And I am willing to testify before Congress under oath, or before any other organization, that what I witnessed was true.
Good morning. My name is Carl Wolf, and I was a precision electronics photographic repairman with a top secret crypto clearance. In the United States Air Force, I was stationed at Langley Air Force Base in Virginia. In 1965, in mid-1965, I was loaned to the Lunar Orbiter Project at NASA on Langley Field. Dr. Colley was in charge of that project. They had problems with a piece of electronic equipment that was bottlenecking their production of photographs. I went to the facility, and when I walked into the facility, there were scientists from all over the world. I was stunned, actually, to see people at a NASA project from all over the world. It didn't make any sense to me initially. I was taken into the laboratory where the equipment was malfunctioning. I couldn't repair it in the dark. I asked to have it removed. A airman second class was in the dark room at that time. I was also an airman second class. I was interested in how the whole process functioned, how the data got from the lunar orbiter to the laboratory. I asked the young man if he described the process to me. He did. About 30 minutes into the process, he said to me, in a very distressed way, by the way, we've discovered a base on the backside of the moon. And then he proceeded to put photographs down in front of me, and clearly in these photographs were structures, mushroom-shaped buildings, spherical buildings, and towers. And at that point, I was very concerned because I knew we were working on compartmentalized security. He had breached security, and I was actually frightened at that moment. And I did not question him any further. And a few moments later, someone did come into the room. I worked there for three more days, and I remember going home and naively thinking, I can't wait to hear about this on the evening news. And here it is, more than 30 years later, and I hope we hear about it tonight. And I will testify under oath before Congress that what I'm saying is the truth.
That was Carl Wolf, electronic photographic repairman. He worked at NASA. And saw many pictures that saw some pictures that of UFOs that he was not supposed to see. You know, I guess some of these people are like feel like Superman when they have these photographs. It's like I have a secret that I know and I'd like to share with you, but I can't. You know, I'm really Superman. So he was able to see some of these photographs. And before that was UFO insider John Maynard. And now let's hear from Larry Warren.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and members of the press. My name is Larry Warren. 20 years ago in 1980, I was a security specialist assigned to RAF Bentwaters, Woodbridge, NATO, Air Force facilities in Suffolk, East Anglia. I had a secret security clearance. I guarded our backline nuclear weapons that were stored there at the time without the knowledge of the people of Great Britain. I went through a portion of a three-night UFO event where objects made incursions over our WSA, fired pencil-thin beams of light into them, and adversely affected the ordnance, possibly. These objects were on the ground on two different nights. Potentially, there was another life form seen. This is an unpopular truth. These events were of extreme defense significance to not only Her Majesty's government, but this government as well, and they are still shrouded in secrecy. They are very complex. They are very vast. This is more about a human rights issue than just a UFO issue. 20 years ago, this room would be empty. I see a turn in history. This is history in motion, but unfortunately, it's history with the security classification. I would be more than honored to swear under oath that I experienced what I did. I saw what I saw. These events produced not only after numerous denials by this government, a memo by Lieutenant Colonel Charles Holt, our deputy base commander, which reads like science fiction. It also produced years later an on-site audio tape he made as these objects performed their feats and did what they did and violated airspace. These events are of extreme defense significance. I hope my brothers in arms that went through these events will be given immunity at some point and be able to join us here. It is an honor to share the stage with all of these people. And I think for all our children, my son Dennis, God bless you, son, we can change the world. You're heroes for being here also, and I will testify in front of Congress if asked to. God bless. Thank you.
That was Larry Warren. The Bentwaters or Rendlesham Forest incident you may have seen on sightings or many different documentaries on UFOs. UFO files on the History Channel or something like that. And these UFOs were seen for several days over the base and shooting down pencil-thin lights to the ground and even landing. And landing in the forest. And they went up, the military people went up and saw this craft at, you know, a few feet away. And even an entity was alleged to have come out of that landed craft. And the skeptics, the cover-up people, the cynics, I call them, they said, oh, there's a lighthouse over there, and that's what they saw was a light from the lighthouse. That's what they mistook for a UFO. Well, these people had been there at this base for quite some time. They were familiar with the lighthouse. And they're not going to mistake the lighthouse for anything else. And as Lord Hill Norton said about this case, either there were UFOs there, or our military is insane. And in either case, it is a matter of national security. So our last one is going to be Mark McCandlish from the Disclosure Project.
Good morning. My name is Mark McCandlish, and for the last 21 years, I have worked as a conceptual artist for a variety of defense contractors. I've been involved in conceptual artwork of the production thereof for Rockwell on the X-30 program, and also on the HISTEP program. That's spelled H-Y-S-T-P, means Hypersonic Testbed Program. During the course of my career, I've twice had a secret security clearance. In 1967, while my father was stationed at Westover Air Force Base, the headquarters for 8th Air Force Strategic Air Command, I witnessed and watched through a telescope a UFO which hovered over a nuclear weapons storage facility for approximately 10 minutes and then departed with an acceleration approaching a bullet leaving a rifle barrel. In 1988, in November, a college buddy of mine, an associate by the name of Brad Sorensen, informed me that he had personally witnessed three flying saucers at a very large hangar at Norton Air Force Base during the course of an air show that was held on Saturday, November 12, 1988. I subsequently called my congressman from that district. I called his office. This was Congressman George E. Brown, Jr., who at the time was the chairman of the Congressional Committee on Space Science and Advanced Technology. I naturally assumed that since this presentation that Brad talked about was for top military brass and certain congressional individuals, that his office must have coordinated this with the local Air Force Office of Public Affairs. A male staff member in Congressman Brown's office not only confirmed the exhibit, but the fact that there were three discs at that exhibit. These discs were hovering off the floor without any visible means of support. They were referred to as alien reproduction vehicles, also nicknamed the Flux Liner because they used high voltage electricity. Let's see. To keep things short, this is a diagram that I made based on a sketch that Brad Sorensen did for me in rough form shortly after he had his sighting, and subsequently cleaned that drawing up and made it much more accurate. And that's the drawing that Dr. Greer is holding there now. Later on, I obtained photographs that were taken in 1967 by a military pilot, Harvey Williams, flying a C-47 for the Air Force at 12,000 feet, approximately 25 miles southwest of Provo, Utah. This particular vehicle matches the so-called ARV in all proportions and respects in terms of the detail of the shape of the craft. And this was photographed, as I say, in June or July of June of 1967. I later spoke to a gentleman by the name of Kent Sellen that I met at an air show at Edwards Air Force Base in 1992, the first unveiling publicly of the B-2 bomber. He indicated to me that in 1973, when he was a crew chief working on experimental aircraft at Edwards Air Force Base, that he had unintentionally wandered into an area where there was a classified aircraft, namely the ARV. He described it in detail, and he added other details to the account concerning the configuration and the operation of the vehicle that Brad Sorensen was not aware of. Subsequently, Brad Sorensen met with the famous aeronautical designer Burt Rutan, gave him a copy of this blueprint, which you've just been shown. Mr. Rutan felt that it was a joke and put it on his wall as kind of a joke. And a third party confirmed for me later that a Colonel Ray Walsh from Edwards Air Force Base was visiting Mr. Rattan, saw this this blueprint on the wall and registered quite a degree of shock and anger, wanted to know where the hell he got this blueprint, because there was, in fact, such a craft at that time, approximately 1994-95, in a hangar at Edwards Air Force Base, North Base Complex at that time. Subsequently, I've done a lot of research on this product, this vehicle. I've come across a number of declassified documents that show that the Air Force, as early as 1960, was wind tunnel testing flying saucer shapes up to Mach 20. And I also have declassified NASA documents that show similar shapes. In fact, this is the document here that more or less details the wind tunnel testing up to Mach 20. This is the NASA document right here that was declassified, and it shows a variety of spherical and lenticular shapes that were flight tested up to, or I should say, wind tunnel tested up to Mach 6. I subsequently obtain a copy of an interoffice memo from Hercules Aerospace that describes a particular type of science involving something called zero-point energy and scalar waves. According to Brad Sorensen, this is the basis of the technology for these anti-gravity propulsion systems. This particular document here describes six different meetings involving the Defense Intelligence Agency and cooperative efforts with the Russian scientific community in investigating this, what is called the fundamental enabling technology that was originally discovered apparently by Nikola Tesla in the early 1900s. Anyway, I could provide you much more detail at a later time, and I am prepared to testify in detail concerning these events and their truthfulness before Congress. Thank you very much.
I find that I do have time for another short testimony. So let's listen to Sergeant Clifford Stone. While in service, Clifford Stone was involved in several recovery missions of crashed UFOs.
Morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name's Clifford Stone. I was Sergeant First Class, United States Army. I had a secret clearance with Nuclear Assurity. I could get the clearance that I needed to do whatever it was that was necessary for me to do at the time on special operations when I was called in on those. What I'm referring to here is that I was involved in situations where we actually did recoveries of crashed saucers, for lack of a better term, debris thereof. There were bodies that were involved with some of these crashes, also some were alive. While we were doing all this, we were telling the American public there was nothing to it. We were telling the world there was nothing to it. I'd like to go into detail on some of the cases about the nuts and bolts cases right here, but I will be available if you have any questions concerning my involvement in this. You can talk to Dr. Greer to arrange for me to get to talk to you. But the whole situation is we've set back, we've told the American people that there's no such thing as UFOs. I've been involved where we have recovered these objects. We know them to be of extraterrestrials. In 1969, I had an event that happened to me while I was stationed at Fort Lee, Virginia. We went to Indiantown Gap, Pennsylvania. That would be my first exposure to any time that we would be recovering an unidentified flying object. When we went there, we already had people that was already in the facility. We were a backup team, which was supposed to be MVC, because there was supposed to be some nuclear materials that was on board this craft. Later on, most people involved were to be told that there was nothing on board it. It was nothing more than just a crash of one of our aircraft. I know better, because I was one of the people that approached it with a Geiger counter to get surface readings. I was the first person to go ahead and see that there were bodies on it. That would be the first of approximately 12 events. UFO crashes are not events that take place every day. They're rare. I know we're not alone in the universe. I know that the absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. It's evidence that has been denied to the American people. I stand before you today in my Almighty God, and I tell you this: if Congress calls me in, and says, will you testify in detail what you know? I stand here today prepared and ready to do just that. Governments must never lie to the people for no reason. Thank you.
This has been a handful of testimonies from the Disclosure Project news conference in Washington, D.C. in 2001. You can listen to all of them, as well as a four-hour video of other firsthand witnesses by going to disclosureproject.org. They're all free at disclosureproject.org. And if you have any questions or comments for me, you can email me at dtwitchell@hotmail.com. This show, as well as all of the forum shows, is now archived at WHFR.FM's website. Click on the forum button on the homepage. We Are Not Alone is also archived at my website, ufoimplications.com. That's ufoimplications.com. Please stay tuned to WHFR.FM, the station making waves, for the best in alternative programming. I want to thank you for joining us today. Please join us again the first Tuesday of each month at 1 p.m. when we will again explore the mysteries of the UFO phenomenon. And until then, this is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky.
WHFR Dearborn.
The orchestra performing at the Ford Community and Performing Arts Center. Next big performance Friday, February the 1st at 8 p.m. Yes, we're talking 2013, but it's not too early to get those tickets. Take a trip to Hollywood with the dazzling showman and pianist Rich Ridenour. He is our guest conductor as well for that Symphony Pops concert. You're going to love it. Great movies, great piano, and great music. For tickets or more details, call this number, 313-565-2424. That's 313-565-2424. Or, as always, check out the website. It's DearbornSymphony.org. Enjoy!
Here's the Fantasia Suite number 8 by John Jenkins. This is the Locke Consort.